Usually I drink heavily when I record a podcast, but my son got a soldering iron for his birthday, so I'm gonna help him learn how to use that.
Oh, that's cool.
When we're done here, so I thought, man, it's probably a best.
Yeah, I will say that understandable to skip the alcohol before using the the big Bernie stick. So
right,
I think it's a wise decision for this one.
So okay, so I'll kind of tell you a little bit about about my podcast. We're called Not Suitable for Anyone. I sort of knew what I wanted to get out of a podcast, and that was really to talk about really sort of underground films that that weren't getting a lot of recognition. And I will say that as part sort of the original concept of this this podcast, that that I should say, the movie you're here to talk about today, the movie you made, The Velocipastor, is probably one of those that's actually too well known to sort of fall under the mission statement for for this show.
I appreciate that. First of all, I will say for the first time, it's a little odd because for the first time in my life, when you work in film, every time somebody finds out that you work in film, the first thing they ask with every good intention is, oh, have you worked on anything I've heard of? And, for me, up until this movie, the answer was no. It's like the truth of the answer was no. And you can sort of like spin your wheels and be like, well, I did this. And it's very odd to finally be like, I actually might have. and once or twice it has proven true. The person got very excited because, everybody that asked that question also expects a negative response. So thank you. I appreciate it. I've been very happy with how much the film's proliferated, of course.
So yeah, I mean, I think if you're, if you're active on, on social media, sort of in any way, this went viral. Even almost, I think, really, like even before it was released, which probably helped things quite a bit. Everyone was talking about it when the trailer started to circulate last year.
So
I guess that was sort of my first question is, I just assume that you consider it a success. When it's probably natural to, when you see something trending and everyone talking about it, that translates to, success and fame and reward and everything for the filmmaker. But I guess that's not necessarily true. Has it achieved sort of the level of success and notoriety that you expected? Has it surpassed it? What are your thoughts?
It's a very interesting question, and one I've tangled a lot with in therapy. But I will tell you that. So first of all, I always thought there would be an audience for the film. I was reasonably sure that based on the and this was before we started shooting, but like based on the title alone, I was like, I feel like someone will buy this, right? Like it just seemed to me it was a title first movie, I don't know, it just seemed to me that I knew there would be some sort of audience. I did not ever imagine in my wildest dreams that a movie based on an English language pun would be big in like Brazil. like that really took me off guard, how the genuinely worldwide appeal of it, in the best way possible, that part I would absolutely consider a success. And the film itself I would as well. In terms of like, I think it's a good movie. I'm like proud of it, because that gets lost in the shuffle too, is do you even like the movie? And the answer is, yeah, I fucking love this movie. I'm very happy in some ways that this was the one that exploded. It gets complicated in terms of like, in my brain, I had always thought that if I make a movie that's a big success, it has to have three things, essentially. It has to be liked. I have to be happy with it. It has to be liked by people, and it has to earn money, right? Like that's a success to me. And jury's still out on the third one. But I will tell you that in terms of just what I think it'll do for my career and what I think it's done for my life, then yes, I think it's an enormous success. Like, it's been so, especially during the pandemic, it's been a source of constant joy to me because I'll just constantly, you know, these are not the happiest times for the world, obviously. And I've felt genuinely very lucky to have something that strangers will text me about just sort of at any hour of the day from any corner of the world being like, hello, here we are in Kazakhstan and we love your movie. It's like that happens to me all the time. And I think that that is astounding, and not in my wildest dreams did I think that would happen. No.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. That's amazing. But it is well deserved.
Thank you.
It's one of those sort of mashup title type of things that, you know, sort of has that potential because it is catchy, and it, you know, ever since Sharknado blew up on Twitter, I don't know. I want to say it was almost 10 years ago.
A decade ago, I think that movie, I think it came out 2012. But yeah, it was like around then.
Yeah. It was around then. Twitter was still relatively new. Mm-hmm. And the reaction to it just exploded, and it spawned an entire franchise of those films. I think they ended up making 5 or 6 of them. And, you know, and it was, I don't know the history or the story behind that one, if the title came first or what it was, but definitely like that was, you know, that was just part of the marketing. Like, we're going to take these two extreme things and just mm-hmm. mash them together.
Yes. A+ B equals C. Yeah.
And
exactly.
And what often happens in those cases is like, that's as far as the creativity goes. And that's as far as like the effort goes into making the movie. But, you know, and honestly, when the email first crossed my desk and I saw the name The Velocipasture, and I laughed, and then I thought, okay, it's going to be another one of these.
Yes.
And then I got the screener and I'm like, holy shit, this is actually a good movie.
You know, I get that a lot. and it's funny because I blame people 0%. It's like the kind of movie that it's almost my favorite thing about its second life on the internet is that overwhelmingly, yeah, the reaction has been, oh shit, it's good. and that's such like a validating feeling, genuinely, to be like, I don't know, like, yeah, it is good. I had fun too. Do you guys want to talk about it? it's a really cool feeling. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think there are a lot of people who just look at that, and, you know, and I'm one of them who, yeah, I was going to watch it anyway, but then you find out, oh, you know, people actually really like it. You know, I'll watch it a little sooner than I was. But there was a lot of reaction to it, even, you know, even before the film was released. I remember, I don't remember who it was, and I don't really want to call him out, but, you know, one of the professional, you know, film critics, you know, kind of criticized the whole thing and said, well, these cult films and the, you know, the quote unquote so bad they're good films, you know, those things happen sort of naturally and by accident, and like, you can't force it to happen, you can't do that intentionally. And, you know, and of course I read that and I said, well, why can't you? That doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, it's so funny because I've seen that a lot as well. A lot of people sort of well, and honestly, so I've seen a lot of people alleging that, yeah, you cannot actually make a so bad it's good movie, like on purpose, that the intentionality behind it is sort of part of the charm, right? That part of the reason that we love The Room is because The Room, or at least Tommy Wiseau, was completely unaware of what the appeal of The Room was when he released it. and it's like, I think there is some merit to that argument. I do. I don't think that's what I did. It's almost like, I feel like I was approaching it slightly from a place of I don't know. I wanted to ape those movies, yes. I wanted to sort of like use their trappings and make it look like that. And quite honestly, with the budget I knew I was working with, it was the only way I figured it would sell. in terms of sell the comedy of it. Like if it was so obviously so low rent from the very beginning, then people are not really expecting all that much. And I thought that might be fun to kind of like catch people off guard with it. I don't know, actually having character arcs and actually like delving into some good filmmaking every once in a while. So I feel like, you know what it is? It's less that I wanted to make a so bad it's good movie, and more that I wanted to recreate the feeling of watching one, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like there's a certain level of fun that comes from watching those movies in a group with your family, with your girlfriend or spouse or kids. And it's almost something you can't replicate on screen. You need an audience to do that part, you know? So I sort of wanted to give an audience every single tool I possibly could to have them laugh at the movie, if that makes sense. Like it's a slightly different intentionality, I think, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I am crazy. And just like I am Tommy Wiseau, and I'm over here being like, let me throw some like film school thoughts at you. And everybody's like, all right, dinosaur priest guy. But yeah, I that was sort of how I was coming at it, honestly. I thought about that like every day on set.
Yeah, no, I bet. And the difference might be subtle, but I think there is a difference.
Yeah, it's hard to articulate. It honestly is, because I've been trying, you know, I've been talking about this film and doing PR for the Velocipastor for, you know, over a year now. So I've had a lot of time to kind of like figure out my thoughts on why I think this one works where some of the other ones don't, you know?
Right.
And I that's the closest I got is that I was trying, because there are certain things in the movie that are like just not really genre appropriate. Like, and I just basically did them because I was like, I don't know, I think we need like a really dope sex scene here. and I know that's not exactly what a grindhouse film would do, but here we go. Yeah. And for the record, I think that is fine. Like, I'm actually happy with the fact that people are sort of having that reaction of like, oh wait, is it actually good? Like that was exactly what I wanted.
Yeah, and I was just gonna say, like, even, you know, even the marketing and even the cover, you know, looks like, you know, looks like some kind of serious grindhouse effort. And I think really it's just, you know, there's a difference between, you know, like, there are bad films that are just bad because of, you know, lack of passion or lack of energy, you know, and it was just, well, we have to put something out. And, you know, maybe there's some level of talent behind the camera, maybe there isn't, but right. You know, but there's just no, you know, no heart to it, and that really kind of comes through in the product. But I mean, this is something that I think you can just feel, you know, you can feel the energy in every scene, you know, in just every shot. You can tell that, you know, when the acting is bad, it's because it's supposed to be, and when the acting is supposed to be good, it is good. And, you know, and you never go more than a couple of pages, it seems like, without, you know, without some, you know, ridiculously over the top, you know, sort of slapstick joke. You know, you have the VFX card sort of in the opening scene, which I think kind of announces the movie right away as what it is. So how important is that in terms of like setting the mood for the audience out of the gate?
It's funny because that joke, a lot of the bad movie jokes were written into the script. They were. And they might not have occurred exactly at the times that I wrote them in, but, you know, there was definitely like the boom mic comes into frame or like they laugh for way too long was written into the script. things like that. Like, it was planned. The VFX card, it was actually not. We were originally going to go back and just film blowing up a model or something. Like, it was supposed to look bad. That was never in question. but we were going to, like, go back and like, get a car model or something and, like, you know, blow it up. And so when I was editing the film, I did truly put that title card in as a placeholder. And I just kept noticing that no matter, it was consistently the first moment everyone laughed. Like, when I would show the film to people, like the person I was seeing at the time, my best friend, other people on the crew, consistently, the moment that card came up, everyone cracked up. And I sort of kept thinking about that. And at a certain point, I was like, I don't think we should go back and reshoot it. Like, I think that this is, like you said, kind of the best possible way to introduce the audience to the world they're about to inhabit for 70 minutes, is that there might be times that the movie just isn't there. And, like, the idea that by second 70, the movie could just break was very funny to me. Because that was, I think that is, when you're talking again about the sort of, the dichotomy between something like a Velocipaster and a Sharknado, you're right, they don't seem to think much beyond the base right. title of it, right?
So Sharknado is definitely not, at least the first one is not aware of what it is as they're making it.
No, not at all. And, you know, they might be vaguely aware that it's quote unquote funny, or like over the top, but they're not really engaging with what's funny about it, in my opinion. And I think one of the cool things about movies like that, when they're done well, when they are like the actual hidden gems that are just insane, is that they can truly go anywhere at any moment. There's like sort of, even no matter how low rent it is, like there's a small part of you watching it being like, where are they going with this? And it's like, you know, early drafts of The Room had him just being a vampire and flying away in a car. And, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, I could see it. Like, that movie is just so out of touch with reality that there's something, there's some part of me that would be like, yeah, I could see that happening. Something like a Repo Man, something like, you know, all of these movies I really sincerely love. They have that element of some sort of free radical of like crazy shit. And I really wanted to do that, because that's one of my favorite things about bad movies, is they don't have like the good taste to not go to Vietnam, you know. And I'm kind of that. So the very long answer to your question, yeah, that was why I kept that at the VFX missing. Because I was kind of, I was like, if this movie is willing to show you that part of its hand so fast, then maybe subliminally the audience will just be like, all right, strap in. I don't know where this is going. And so that was my hope. And I think it's achieved that. I'm actually very, I truly did not know if that would work, honestly. And I have gotten many film festivals that emailed me back being like, we love the movie. I think you sent us the wrong cut. I truly, that happened to us about like 15 times. And we had to very politely explain to them, no. We are simply maniacs, sir. But yeah, so it was important to me. I'm very happy I ended up making that decision, because I almost didn't.
Yeah, it is a great moment. It's kind of it reminds me of like you know, like a Gremlins 2 like type of gag, you know, mm-hmm. where the film actually burns.
Yes,
and then they cut to like the movie theater, and like I think Hulk Hogan shows mm-hmm. up at some point, but it would be like doing that, but in the first 2 minutes.
Like exactly, like right out the gate. yes, exactly. That was what I was going for.
You know, I've gotten movies before with like a temp audio track. Mm-hmm. We had a whole discussion internally of, I wonder if this is the finished film. Like, is that a joke? Like, we were actually debating, like, because, you know, my first instinct was to laugh, and my second instinct was, is this a joke?
Yes, exactly.
And part of it is because the sound design is so good in that moment. Like, you can hear the flames.
And that is an important thing. The sound design was not there when I first did that joke. And so it was when people started laughing, I remembered saying to my sound designer, like, really sell it. Like, really sell that this is like an inferno that we just like did not see. I that is exactly what I was hoping would happen, because it is the kind of thing that I've definitely accidentally sent the wrong cut to people of a movie. I think everybody has, or received the wrong cut. So I never blamed people for thinking we did that, but that it was so funny, because that is exactly like sort of the internal interaction you guys were having over at your place is exactly what I wanted. Like, it's the kind of thing where in a perfect world, the best way to see this movie, in my opinion, is streaming it on your couch with a couple of people you know, having no idea what you're in for. Because basically, once that moment hits, you're all going to start talking to each other. And you're almost invariably going to be like, wait a minute. Like, and start, I don't know, that is the fun of it to me. Like, you can watch this film totally alone and have a good time, but it's in a group that it really gets unlocked, in my opinion. And it's, that's how I feel about it.
Absolutely. And because, you know, it's layered, because, you know, initially I thought the joke was that we're going to blow up his parents in this massive car, you know, massive explosion. Yep. 1 minute into the film, you know, here we go. and that is, I mean, and even that alone, I think, you know, is something that would kind of be morbidly funny. Mm-hmm. But then you throw this in on top of it, and you realize, you sort of start to realize, like, where all the places it's going to go. There's a number of title card jokes throughout.
Yep. It's very funny to me. And I will say, exactly. I think that this is a movie that I am completely and honestly comfortable saying to people, if you're not having fun by, like, I don't know, somewhere between minute 5 and 10, like turn the movie off. Because it's truly, there's nothing for you there. It's like, this is what the movie is. And I wanted to be honest with people about that pretty quickly. Because I knew, even when we were making it, like, you know, this is a movie that people will love or hate. And it's that simple. There will just be a certain part of the audience that will never like a movie like this. And you can make, like, the perfect ballistic missile of it. And it's just not for them, and that's fine. There's some people that don't like Airplane, you know?
Right.
And I wanted to be kind of assault everybody with its personality up front so they could leave if they wanted to. Because I think that's a totally valid option. I take genuinely no offense if people feel that way about it.
Yeah. It's the kind of thing that's not, you know, it's not necessarily for everyone, but, but I think if it's on your wavelength, I mean, obviously there's an audience for it.
Yes.
One of the things,
If it's your thing, it's your thing, which I'm very happy about.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a movie for me, because I knew it was my thing. And it's very humbling and heartening to see that resonated with so many people, honestly. Also, it's just fun. I'm happy people are having fun out there.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. And it was interesting. I was looking at Letterboxd earlier, and, you know, most movies on Letterboxd, you know, the majority of them tend, you know, the ratings kind of follow a bell curve. You know, some of the things that are kind of universally beloved, you know, really, like, you know, ramp up on the right side or something. But Velocipaster is kind of flat across the top. It's like no one can sort of come to a consensus on it.
Yup, I noticed that too. And I think it's because a lot of people they're genuinely unsure if we are in on the joke. And they're unsure if we are in on the joke, what that means to their opinion. Like, because there are some people that are like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And then when they realize that, like, you know, we're real filmmakers and we wanted to make a comedy, they kind of lose interest because of that sort of like, that kind of genre idea of purity, right? That it can't be like a truly good, bad movie if it was intentionally done to do so. There's something like punk music in there, like where authenticity is a part of it. Like that's actually a part of the appeal of it to some people. And so, you know, it is very interesting to me to see how people have reacted. I'm happy to have confounded the world. So it is a feather in my cap. So yeah, I left my own review on Letterboxd and I hope people like it.
Yeah, no, that's great. Decide where I want to go next.
No, of course.
So let's talk about this because the title came first, mm-hmm. right? And it got me thinking about this and how many bar bets might have been lost because the first that we know of, you know, movie title inspired by autocorrect, you know, wasn't called Ducking Hell or.
Yup. Oh, God, the one that keeps getting me these days is, for some reason, my phone keeps auto-correcting that to thar, like T-H-A-R, thar, and it's so horrible, because I'm from Montana, and never in my life have I said thar, and now in my text messages, I'm just like full-bore cowboy, apparently, but yeah, anywho, yeah, it did, in fact, come from an autocorrect. That is real ass truth. Yeah, it came from it happened in 2011 when I was at film school and texting my friends about dinosaurs, as any hot-blooded young American male does. And yeah, sure enough, it autocorrected Velociraptor to Veloci Space Pastor. And you know, I just seen Grindhouse. I was a huge fan of Tarantino Rodriguez. And I was watching a lot of trailers from hell. Like I was sort of in that nascent stage of really getting into cult film, extreme cinema, European cinema, trash cinema, Mondo cinema, like all of that. I was really just discovering it then. And so when my phone auto-corrected to Velocipastor, truly my only thought in 2011 was, I don't know, it sounds like a movie. And then I put my phone away and I didn't think about it again. But it like kept rattling around in my brain because it was just so funny. And truly the thing that held me back for so long was that for a very long time, I was one of those people that was like, you can't truly make a good, bad movie on purpose. And then at a certain point, I was like, yeah, but I'm going to try it. Like, or at the very least, I sort of figured out how I would approach it. And the more I thought about it, the more I had to do it. Yeah. So we ended up shooting it in 2016. And yep, then we went viral 2019. And here we are.
There's several pieces that come into play here. You've got the inspiration from autocorrect. Mm-hmm. And then you've also got the second piece here is the dinosaur costume.
Yes. Correct. which was extant before when that autocorrect happened. Yes. Would you like me to talk about the genesis of the costume?
Yes, please.
Okay. So. excuse me. Yeah, the costume existed before the movie. What happened was I was essentially the leader of my high school's film club. And every year they gave us some budget to do something. And so one year we were going to make a remake of the 1970s movie, The Last Dinosaur, starring Richard Boone. And it's just sort of like a really fun, really bad made for TV movie about hunting down a dinosaur, kind of like The Lost World kind of stuff. The Lost World, but it sucks, is basically what the movie is. And so we were going to make that, and the teacher advisor commissioned a costume. And he used Pennsylvania tax dollars to buy a costume for us. And it was shipped to my house, and that is the costume in the 2019 film Velocipaster. It was in my basement from 2008, because what ended up happening was the principal of our high school came in the day before we were going to shoot The Last Dinosaur and told us that the script was too violent and we needed to find something else. But he did not ask me for the costume back. I'm not 100% sure that he was aware that his school had bought the costume. And since he is no longer principal, I don't mind telling you, Mr. Gress, we owned a costume. So, it was just in my basement. And when the autocorrect happened, one of my thoughts genuinely was, oh, we could use the dinosaur costume, because it had just been there. It was just sitting in my basement, because what else am I going to do with it, you know? It's such an unbelievably bizarre prop. And I do consider it nearly a member of my family at this point. We have named it Boone, after the actor Richard Boone, who was the star of The Last Dinosaur. And Boone is still in my parents' basement. It is still sitting there, and it will probably never leave. I think that if we ever do get rid of it, I want to give him a Viking funeral and film it. Like, I would want to like set it aflame and push it out on a lake and just be like, yeah, this is the only real way to say goodbye to this.
It definitely belongs in a museum.
Yes, I would love to donate it to some insane exhibit somewhere. That would make me very happy.
That's great. Who knew that the 2020 election would only be the second best thing to ever come from the good citizens of Pennsylvania?
I know, right? Oh, we are a very proud people. Gritty saved us, guys. it's very funny. So I was from Montana originally, and I moved to Pennsylvania when I was very young. So I do consider myself probably Pennsylvania. And so I was very proud of the boys, as they say.
Okay, so we have the title, and you have the costume, and then the third piece of the puzzle all of this coming together, it just feels very unlikely, or feels like, you know, sort of a set of plot conveniences. Like if these were in a movie, you'd be like, isn't this convenient? Isn't that convenient?
Truly, yes.
Because the third part of it is the financing, and that was a really unusual story in itself.
Yes. So. Here's how we got the financing for Velocipaster. I was seeing my girlfriend at the time, I was very serious with, and her mom happened to be an art curator, right? And so she knew some people in the art world and things like that. And she was a very sweet lady. We got along very well. And we still do. She's wonderful. But she called me, you know, my ex knew that I was really struggling to get this project off the ground. And her mom called me one day and was just kind of like, you know, hey, how much money do you think you would need to actually make this movie? And, you know, when you work in film, this happens to you a lot. Like people mean the absolute best, but they just are sort of, you know, this was hardly the first time I've had somebody's relative be like, hey, I might know a guy, you know.
Oh, I'm sure.
But the thing is, you got to sort of chase every lead because you never know. And so I sort of off the cuff was like, I don't know, we could probably do it for like $30,000, 30 to 35. And a day or two later, she had found a rich Taiwanese woman who gave us $35,000, no questions asked, $35,000 USD. And so, yeah, within 2 days, the film was financed. And I don't know. I've never met this woman. I truly, to this day, have never met this angel investor who gave me $35,000 to make Velocipaster. She asked for nothing except Chinese distribution rights. And then when we were done with the film, definitely did not remember she gave money to the movie. I think that she is the kind of person that is just so wealthy that she literally forgot that she gave some American kid $35,000. Like, I've known people who can drop that on shopping, you know?
Right.
Like, they can just go into a store and that's just the state of their wealth. And so I truly think that this woman was somebody like that, because every time I've tried to contact her, she genuinely does not know who I am and does not care about this movie. So that is how the film got financed. Yep. We ended up shooting for 35. And I did most of the post myself. With the people I hired for post, I think we crept up to about 40,000.
Okay.
And that last 5 or 6 would have been out of my own pocket.
Okay. Yeah. And I promised someone that I would ask you, you know, who did the craft services for this movie, since it's the kind of thing that, you know, that looks like it's, you know, shot in your parents' backyard. So
yep. I can tell you that our AD Gabriel's sister was very nice, and she cooked food for us a couple of days. Really good food too. Yeah, we just ordered local, honestly. I mean, we shot in Pennsylvania, so the good thing about shooting somewhere a little more off the beaten path, and I encourage any young filmmakers to do this, any filmmakers period, is that people are generally very excited to work with you, you know, and they will, like, put it this way, if you live in Los Angeles and you want to shoot a movie, let's say you want to shoot a scene in a magic shop, that's where we shot the exorcism scene for Velocipastor, the scene with Voltaire in it. We shot in a real magic shop in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. And so if I wanted to shoot this movie in New York or Los Angeles, first and foremost, I'm probably going to be paying, $5,000 to $10,000 location fee, right? That'll be to cover the money that the location would lose when you're filming there. You're also, if you're shooting in a place like that, going to definitely have to take out insurance, because, you know, what if a member of the crew breaks something? These places usually have a lot of glass, a lot of crystals, things like that. It's a very, you know, you can very quickly bull in a china shop with a C-stand if you're not careful. So you're talking like 15K minimum. And then you're going to have to, pay every member of the crew. And when you get to something like craft services, probably what you would have to do is there are tons of craft services organizations in the greater Los Angeles area, and they will charge you whatever their going rate is for a production. Or if you shoot in Pennsylvania, you know what you can do. Oh, also, you're going to have to remember that you also need a filming permit, parenthetically. So you're going to have to spend a couple more, probably 2,000 to 3,000 more, dealing with the commission, dealing with SAG, dealing with all of that. So to shoot that scene in Los Angeles, you're already looking at, like, conservatively 10,000 to 20,000, right? For that scene.
Right.
And so in Pennsylvania, I walked into a magic shop. I asked them if I could shoot there, and they said, yeah, sure, it sounds fun. And then we came in and I didn't pay them a goddamn thing, because every member of the crew was encouraged to buy parts of their merchandise. Members of my crew go back there all the time, and we're all like friends with the owner now.
That's cool.
I ended up with my family. I went back to that magic shop to finally give them their copy of the movie. And yeah, we all bought stuff, and they have been nothing but very happy with how things went. And so shooting somewhere off the beaten path, you have interactions like that more. Where for craft services for this film, my AD or my producer contacted local businesses, local delis, and basically we're kind of like, hey, look, we have to serve 10 people on 4 days this week. What would that rate be? They would give us a quote, and then we'd negotiate to something that we thought was fair for everybody. And yeah, no complaints. Everybody was very cool with it. And I feel like it's funny, because when you say it out loud, it sounds exploitative, because it actually is a better idea and saving you money. And I think that it's not exploitative if you're fair about it, and if you're just upfront with people, and if you kind of you know, tell them what your plan is and see if they're interested. Worst case scenario, they say no. Or even if they ask for some location fees, it's not going to be, you know, $6,000-$7,000. They might ask for a couple hundred bucks, and that's fine. So I don't know. Yeah. I think that was how we kept costs down with things like Crafty, with things like just general film costs, you know, the things that drive every film budget up.
Right. Yeah, I think I've heard that from, I was talking to the Pierce brothers, the guys that made the Wretched.
Of course, yeah.
And they had said something similar, because they, for both of their feature films, they went home to Michigan to shoot those.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and what they had said is that, you know, people in, you know, in small towns and people where you're from, you know, are, you know, sort of genuinely excited to help you out. Whereas, you know, I imagine that in LA, it's just business.
Exactly. And it's like, it's not, I mean, I understand it from both perspectives, where it's kind of like, look, if you are a small business owner in Los Angeles, I'm sure this is like a weekly occurrence that somebody will come in and be like, hey, can we shoot here for free? It's like, I get why after a while you would be like, uh-huh, yeah, $3,000 kid. Like, I understand it. But it is difficult, especially when you're an indie filmmaker and when you're like a no budget indie filmmaker. Like, the fact of the matter is, the system in a place like Los Angeles or New York is the infrastructure of the film business in places like that is built for studios. It's built for people with money. You know, if Disney hears that, they'll be like, yeah, whatever. And just, you know, throw money at it and get and shoot. And everybody's happy then too. The difference is that, you know, for people that don't have access to that kind of money, it makes things very prohibitive for you. And I think that going someplace smaller, going probably back to wherever you're from, is the better way to get more bang for your buck, especially if you're doing a feature, because, you know, you're going to have to be there a bit.
I want to transition a little bit. We haven't talked a whole lot about the movie, but I think.
Oh yeah.
You know,
how about that?
I think it's pretty clear from from everything, you know, that anyone listening to the podcast, you know, anyone certainly that's been following along with the movies, you know, that we've, you know, that I've talked about on here so far, they may have already seen The Velocipastor. They've at least heard of it. Definitely recommending checking that out. One of my favorite things about the movie, and that's not a knock against the rest of the movie itself, but the music and sort of the musical montages, there's several of them throughout the film. That really honestly became, you know, sort of my favorite part of the whole experience. And it's not to say that the rest of the movie is bad. It's just that I think the soundtrack is just that good. And the editing in those sequences is just that good.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I love the soundtrack to this movie. So what ended up happening was, I knew, kind of as I had mentioned before, I had intimated it earlier on this podcast, but I thought that there was something early on when I was really thinking about, if I wanted to make The Velocipastor, how would I approach it? Like, what would be, you know, if you're going to try and do the paradox of how do you make a good bad movie, what would that sound like? What would the soundtrack to it sound like? And it's funny, because this was one of those moments where I was kind of like, being truthful is probably less smart here, because it's like, the fact of the matter is, real bad movies like that, their soundtracks suck. It's like, so often it's just like some person that they, it's terrible. It's mind-scratchingly terrible usually. And for this one, I thought, you know, I have $35,000. I can't make The Departed for that. But maybe I could make like the Ramones' first album, you know, like something that's so scrappy and doesn't, and just sort of wears its backyardness on its sleeves. And of course, that translated to how we actually shot the movie. But I thought that that kind of punk rock DIY ethos was interesting and like somewhere in the DNA of this project. So I approached two bands about music. A band called The Holy Mess. And a band called Math the Band. Both of which I knew through like friends of friends. And they were gracious enough to allow us to use some of their music. The opening credits ended up being my band, a band called Free Parking. Which I am the singer-songwriter and, I guess leader of. That was not the original intention. I'm usually a little gun-shy about using my own music in my movies, but there were like some rights issues with the song I really wanted for the opening credits, and so I thought that might be the case. The artist who had performed it had already passed away, and it was unclear who owned the song. We just never really got to the bottom of it. So, in preparation for that, I recorded with Free Parking, the opening theme that we ended up using. So good on me for having that foresight, because otherwise, So that was how we got to what the music would sound like. And so the actual editing of it, the big moment of that in the movie is the sex scene, right?
Right, right.
With Math the Band's Didn't Even Have Time to Think playing under it. I edited this movie in Latvia, the country of Latvia. I was there for a shoot. Don't go to Latvia, but I was stuck there. It was a night. I happened to be up at night a lot there. So I was in a country whose language I didn't speak. I didn't really have anything to do. I was just up at night a lot. And so
George Costanza converting to Latvian Orthodox for a woman?
Kind of. No, so the whole story was that same serious girlfriend was about to shoot her first feature film. She is a cinematographer. And they were going to shoot it in Latvia. And from the word go, I knew this was going to be a train wreck of a shoot. and she just really wanted to go. And, you know, she was a not very physically imposing Asian woman. And I thought that there was a chance that she could run into danger in Eastern Europe trying to order around a bunch of Russian and Latvian men. So I flew out there to give moral support because I knew she was going to do it because that's just the kind of person she was. Right. And it turns out that, she was in no fucking danger whatsoever, but the shoot was a train wreck. So I flew out there, to just basically be there for my girlfriend and kind of be like, hey, I know that every night when you get home, you're going to want to complain about what just happened and I'm here for it, you know? But what that meant was that it was an entire month of night shoots for her. And I was just kind of stuck in the Latvian Airbnb to editing this movie. and so it was just a very strange period of my life. I'm happy I did it because it was just, you know, a very singular experience. But it is the kind of thing that when you're in the dark Eastern European night, there's definitely... I think with a scene like the sex scene, I kind of edited myself out of a depression. You know what I mean? Like, I was kind of being like, how far can I push this? The ethos I had was, what if this is the one scene in the movie where we kind of show our cards and show that we're good, you know?
Yeah.
Because I was kind of like the obvious joke. And in the script, I remember it said something along the lines of like, of course there's a sex scene in this dinosaur priest movie. Like, use your imagination. And when we actually got there to that part of what the movie had to be, I was kind of like, you know, there's a lot of very easy jokes you can make with it. A lot of very like sort of puerile jokes, like he's a priest, she's a sex worker, he turns into a dinosaur. This is very possibly him losing his virginity, you know? Like there's a lot of very obvious jokes you can go for. And I thought it would be not funnier, but at the very least more interesting if we approached the sex scene in the movie as like the one part of the movie that we actually shot like it was an art film. Like we actually took it seriously and we're kind of like, no, this is not, it's not that they're about to fuck, it's that they're about to like very sweetly make love and like have it be like this really emotional moment for everybody. And for some reason I just thought that would be funny. And I'm very happy I did it. I think it was what the movie needs at that moment. So yeah, that was sort of where I was coming from with the whole thing. Lots of Suspiria, lots of, I don't know, just sort of interesting frames within frames within frames compositions. It was when I got to flex my film schooly knowledge of people like Stan Brakhage. And be like, hell yeah, I get to do flashy frames. And so, yeah, that was sort of where I was coming from with it. Just the joy of creating it. And please get me out of Latvia. So I want everybody to know when they're watching that movie that while editing, I probably had two very cheap tall boys next to me. And it's kind of just like, uh-huh, another Latvian night. Really quick sidebar. One night I got so bored, I went into Riga proper, where we were saying, and I did karaoke at a Latvian bar. I sang My Own Worst Enemy by the band Lit, and everyone hated it. Then I went home and edited more of the Velocipaster. So that was Latvia.
Oh, man.
Anyway.
Yeah. I remember I was watching it on a plane, and, you know, and then I realized, you know, I'm like watching this movie and I realized, oh, they're going to fuck. And I was in, you know, kind of a public place. So I sort of like, you know, turned down the brightness on my screen and sort of angled it towards me. And cause I didn't know, I was,
of course,
I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
Like I thought, you know, honestly, I was expecting like maybe like something like Dolomite. At that point,
yep, or Wolf Cop or something. Yeah,
but
sure.
But then you see, and by the time it gets to, you know, like there's a bridge in that song. In the Math the Band song,
yeah.
And you know, and you've got all the different shots that are just in tiles. And then, you know, and then the background, you know, framing just accentuates that with that stained glass, which almost looks like a comic book panel at that point.
Yeah. I was definitely, you know, it's funny. I always reread the Parker graphic novels before I storyboard, by Darwin Cook. I think that Darwin Cook was one of the best comic book artists to ever live. And I think that his work in especially panel composition is just astoundingly good. And so it is funny. So I probably was thinking of comic books to a certain extent, honestly. I'm a huge comic book fan. So, yeah.
Yeah. It looks fantastic. So the long story short of my story is I ended up rewinding it and watching the whole scene again.
Perfect. I definitely, I always like to watch that scene in a theater.
Yeah.
Just because I love that song, honestly. I really adore that song.
It is.
And so I love hearing that in a theater.
Yeah. And my working theory is that by sleeping with the priest is how Carol gets ninja
kung
powers.
Kung fu powers, yes.
Because that's immediately like a transition to like the third act.
She just knows. She knows. Don't worry about it. You know, I will say that when we get, well, yeah. Yeah, stick with that theory for now. I have thoughts about why and how Carol knows kung fu, and hopefully we get to explore them in future movies.
So I know that people are throwing ideas and things like that at you for Velocipaster 2.
Yes.
You know, the subtitle I want to throw at you, which is yours to have, because I wrote it into my review. I referred to the priest as a literal bird of prey, with prey spelled P-R-A-Y.
Ooh, I like that. Like that, actually. A bird of prey is good. Yeah, I'm into that.
So there you go. So the last thing I wanted to do is I looked up on Amazon. So the movie's available everywhere. We should probably say that.
Yes.
The movie is available on everywhere on digital. There's a region-free Blu-ray from Wild Eye. Yeah.
Yes.
Releasing. The Blu-ray is fantastic. I highly recommend it. But if you just want to check it out and you have Amazon Prime or something, you can check it out for free. But Amazon does this thing where they have the, you know, people who watch this also watched these other movies.
Oh, sure, sure.
So I want to just run down this list with you. Because there's some in here I imagine that you've seen. There's some that I had never heard of.
Please, I for the record, I do not know what it recommends. Okay. So this will be a surprise to me.
And this might be different for everyone. This may just be what
it's
recommending to me. But so the first one is Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter.
Uh huh. Yeah, classic. Of course.
The next one is Llamageddon.
Good. all the boys are here.
I don't know. I have actually seen Llamageddon, and I highly recommend it.
I've actually seen neither of these.
It's about a space llama, and his spaceship is a horse trailer that just flies under its own power. Like they welded wings to the sides of a horse trailer.
Dope.
But there's no glass or anything like enclosing it, so it's just flying through space through the vacuum of space. It's amazing. Okay, the third one that I've also seen this one is Spaghetti Man.
Interesting.
That's another one I'd recommend. This is a superhero movie.
Yeah, that's the first one I don't know, actually.
He shoots spaghetti out of his hands.
Incredible.
That's a really good one. The next one I think a lot of people probably know is Thanksgiving.
Yes. I have seen Thanksgiving.
Yes. And then Inhuman Witch. I've seen Inhuman Witch is enough. That's like an homage to like the 50s sci-fi creature features.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was chewing on that title for a second.
It's like a radioactive man witch.
Oh, gotcha. Cool. All right. Yeah, I'll take it. a good rogues gallery around my movie.
And then here's where it gets strange.
Oh, okay.
Then you've got Killer Pinata.
Whoa. All right.
Which I haven't seen or heard of, but it's going on the list.
Good.
Space Trucker Bruce.
Huh.
Karis, all right. Karis Hell.
I have seen Karis Hell, and I know the filmmaker of that. He's a very nice guy. His name is Steve.
Yeah, that's one. That's on my list. I still need to see that one.
Yeah.
I'm kind of afraid to see this next one. It's called Obamaland, Rise of the Trump Publicans.
Oof. If it's a Dinesh D'Souza, always a role. Yeah, it's so funny. Every time I see any politicized documentary, I guess, is about an American president that is still alive, I'm just sort of like, that's probably going to be a pass for me, dog. It just seems like something that I'm like, I don't think anybody knows what to make of that yet. So, you know what? Good. I'm glad that viewers of the Velocipaster can really delve into the Trump publicans.
This next one, actually, I'm really interested in this next one. FDR, American Badass.
Okay, I've seen parts of that. That's another Wild Eye movie, and it rules. It's like very, they did a lot of like archival footage that they cut in.
Okay.
It's actually pretty cool. I have not seen the whole film, but I've seen clips of it. When we were thinking about going with Wild Eye, we watched some clips of some of their movies. And FDR American Badass was actually the one that sold me. That was the one that I was like, okay, I think they'll get it. Like, I still have not seen the whole film, but yeah, I was really impressed by the trailer. So,
okay, awesome.
Yeah.
All right. So, and then the next one's a classic. It's Zombievers.
Oh, yep.
And then...
Yeah, we played with them in a Fantasia. With first film, Animosity.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fun one. All right, the next one is Sharktopus, Whale Wolf.
Hey, guys. You get one. you get Sharktopus or Whale Wolf.
Oh, sorry. It's Sharktopus versus Whale Wolf.
Gotcha. The battle of the century. That makes a little more sense. Yeah. I thought that it was just like they were stating them as two separate facts. They were like Sharktopus, Whale Wolf. Okay, cool. Right. I might watch that one then.
I remember this next one because it came out around the same time as Velocipaster, and it's Clownado.
Yes. I have also seen Clownado. It's another Wild Eye film. I met Todd at the first event we did after Velocipaster went viral. Was a convention called Texas Frightmare, right?
Okay.
And we were at the Wild Eye booth there. We got to meet Todd Sheets because, yeah, Clownado had just come out. And it was funny because Clownado was the one that they were sort of promoting at the booth. They were promoting Velocipaster and Clownado. Because we were there to screen Velocipaster and Clownado had just been released. We weren't even out on DVD yet or anything. We were just sort of there to do a pre-screening. And so I got to meet Todd. He's a really nice guy. He's much taller than me. But it's funny because that was the first time, that event was the first time that I realized that the film was like blowing up. it was the first time, you know, it was me, Jesse, and Greg, and we had all gone down there to Texas to kind of be like, you know, we'll show solidarity, maybe we'll sign a poster. We ran out of posters in like 2 hours. We were on our feet for 2 days straight talking to fans and signing things and just like, you know, hanging out. It was cool as hell. It was probably my favorite event I've attended with Velocipaster. So yeah, I've seen Clownado.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, the next one is Attack of the Killer Donuts.
Dope. Into it.
Followed by Santa Jaws.
All right.
The Jurassic Games.
Okay, all right, a little closer.
Bubba the Redneck Werewolf.
All right.
Here's another very good one. Dave Made a Maze.
Oh, I've heard of this. I have not seen it.
Yeah, this is good. This is another one that this is like a filmmaker's film. Like it's all about, you know, the creative process and, you know, sort of the existential crisis of, you know, of creating something and not wanting to, you know, let it go and stuff. But it's also like, you know, it's like a cardboard maze that he builds inside his living room. But then when you go inside, it's like this entire fantasy world.
That's cool.
It's really neat.
Yeah.
And almost to the end of the list here, it's about to get really strange because the last two are, there's Midget Zombie Takeover.
Whoa. Got it.
And then of all things, I don't understand this one. Friday the 13th, Part 6.
Cool. Why Part 6?
Like, yeah, why just that one?
I don't even know which one that is. I've seen up to 5. Man, I guess that's just telling me that I need to keep going with the Friday the 13th movies.
I don't know.
That's a recommendation just for Brendan Steer.
You definitely should check out part six there. And maybe there's this whole paintball. Part six is the one with the paintball guys. There's like guys running around the woods with paintball guns.
Yeah, I definitely have not seen that one. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, now I need to. That's my takeaway out of that entire list. I'm like, cool, I gotta see Friday the 13th part 6. I am the problem. That's so funny. Yeah, I remember for a while there was a very brief blip of time when we first came out that like the big release that came out that week was The Lighthouse. So it was recommended under us. And all I could think was a double feature of the Velocipaster and The Lighthouse is like a suicide cocktail. Like, what? Oh my God. Who would possibly do that? To just be like, cool, we had a great time. Now let's lock ourselves into this room. Man, I love The Lighthouse, for the record. I think it's an astoundingly good film, but it's like a bad time movie. I love that movie.
Well, it's funny. It's funny you bring up The Lighthouse because you recommended on Twitter. You recommended Lake Michigan Monster.
Yes.
And I went out and got bought the Arrow Blu-ray.
Oh, nice! I'm looking at my copy right now.
Yeah, and I highly recommend it. But the first thing that went through my head when it started was it just made me think of The Lighthouse. Though it's really it's nothing like The Lighthouse. In most ways, but in some ways, it's very much like The Lighthouse.
Yes. So they have similar a lot of close-ups of bearded men shouting. It's in black and white. It has that very northern feel.
Yeah.
It's funny because I met those guys at the premiere of it in L.A. I was just really fucking blown away by it. I loved it. And so they were very inspired by this Canadian filmmaker that I also love called Guy Madden. And Guy Madden's films are all like that. Like, they're all like just this very strange peek into like some black and white world with text that pops up on screen and it'll just say things like lies, lasciviousness, and then you're like, okay, what does that mean? He's a Canadian filmmaker, and so I think that maybe through osmosis in the UP they got some of his Canadianness. I adore Lake Michigan Monster, though. I think that I'm very excited that they've agreed to work with us on the next Velocipaster film.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, because they're obviously so much more adept at CGI effects than I am. I think the work they did with their green screen and their animation team is astoundingly good. And I'm just sort of like, yeah, people should see that movie. It rules. They also, for the record, and this is something that I do not get to say a lot, they made that movie for less money than I did. They made that movie for under $10,000. And I'm astonished they managed to. So yeah, everybody check out Lake Michigan Monster. It's a really good film. And especially if you liked Velocipaster, you'll fucking dig it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I described it to someone as like saying that it was like, it's like if a 13-year-old wrote and directed The Lighthouse.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it. Yep. It shares with Velocipaster that same almost childish wonder.
Yeah.
Of like, what if movies could be this? and I think I sense a kinship with
another great title card joke when the guy's like, well, we know it's Lake Michigan. It's the name of the movie.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my God. All the stuff they do on screen with that. Like they're planning the planning sequences when the captain's sort of being like, all right, here's what we'll do. And like, and you're just like seeing the little dots come alive on screen. I love that. Yeah. I love that film. So yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, I, Brendan, I appreciate your time. I want to be respectful of that. So I think we can leave it there. Everyone, please check out Velocipastor. Everyone, please check out Lake Michigan Monster. These are both great movies and a great time. You know, get your friends together and you know, have a few drinks and have a few laughs. Come out to the coast. Just don't go crawling through an air vent with a cigarette lighter.
Yes. yes.
Yeah, that joke kind of came together backwards. I don't like.
It took me a second. But yeah, I will say that. Yeah, I hope everybody enjoys it. It's out on it's still on Amazon Prime right now. It's playing on Tubi, on Hoopla, and yeah, you can if you're not in North America and you're listening, then yeah, the Blu-ray is region free, and you can play it. So I hope everybody enjoys, and I hope that if they check out Velocipastor, it's a nice bright spot in their day.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Brendan, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
All right, take care.
You too.